Welcome to the Millennial Therapist Podcast with Mao and Nao.
This podcast is hosted by two millennial therapists who are true crime, forensic psychology, and macabre obsessed.
This is not your typical mental health podcast where only mental health and social work topics are discussed. We dabble in various topics from cultural humility to military mental health to ghosts to interesting ways our parents use the paranormal to discipline us. El cucuy, anyone?
Why so many topics? Because we're millennials. To make things more interesting, one is an Air Force veteran and a mom of two. The other is currently serving active duty, and both are children of immigrants working to honor their ancestors. Warning, listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to the Millennial Therapist Podcast. Today we're going to explore the murder of Travis Alexander and the case of Jody Arias. This is a discussion between two therapists who are trained and licensed to diagnose. However, this still is our own personal opinion. So everything that we do speak about, do not sue us because we're just two millennials that are interested in murder. That happened to be therapist. My main thing for this case is we're going to definitely go into the murder, but really explore their relationship, their dynamics, both Jody and Travis's, what their relationship looked like, because it definitely was not a healthy one from what I've been seeing. Media has really put this, she's this pretty girl that did such an evil thing. And when she went into her defense, she painted a picture of him as this domestic violence perpetrator. It'll be interesting to hear your thoughts, Nao. To begin, Travis Alexander was found murdered in Mesa, Arizona when he did not show up for an important Cancun trip with his friend. So when they broke into his house, I guess it was like 2 or 3 days later that he had supposed to go on this trip, and they found his brutally mutilated body with 27 to 29 stab wounds, a gunshot wound in the head, and his throat was slit from ear to ear, and they found him in the bathroom. When the police forensic investigators arrived on scene, they noticed a bloody palm print and a digital camera found in the washing machine. They didn't really have any suspect. They didn't know of any people that wanted to harm him until they started interviewing his friends and family. And almost immediately, and almost everybody said, you should check out his ex-girlfriend, Jody Arias, because she is super jealous and she's kind of sketch, and we've always felt a little weird around her. Alexander's friends told 2020 that they started noticing red flags with Arias early on in the relationship. They said that they alerted Alexander to their concerns and that they even grown concerned for his safety as things grew toxic and volatile between the two. So their friend said, I started seeing things that were just disturbing. And I said, Travis, I'm afraid we're going to find you chopped up in a freezer. From very early on, she was completely obsessed with him.
Normally you tell like a friend, hey, things don't seem healthy, you know, maybe it's time for you guys to separate. But to make such a like an expression of fear to end up in such a way, that had to tell you something.
And I guess she was very impulsive. She supposedly would go into his house. She found a code and she would get into his house and sneak into his garage and wait for him there. She would show up unannounced and uninvited. She was definitely stalking for the most part. So they pulled her in and started interrogating her. And then the investigator detective said, like, immediately, we have a lot of forensic evidence. She gave a lot of different stories. She says she was not there at all. She had an alibi. She was blatantly lying and making these stories up on the go. And then eventually she was like, oh no, I was there. It was in two intruders that killed him.
Very unreliable.
Yes, she was not a good reporter. So she said, okay, I was there. There were two people. They were white Americans with face masks. And they tried to rob us and they ended up shooting him. She called them ninjas, like these two ninjas. Like, it's weird. So they found the bloody palm print. They found the pictures of her. So now they had to essentially create this timeline. She was charged with his murder because the bloody handprint had her DNA and his DNA in it. That camera that they found in the washing machine, she threw it in there, but they were able to retrieve like the memory card from it and found pictures of them.
So did she wash it or?
She tried to wash it. They had pictures of them engaging in sexual intercourse. Like they were boning, taking sex pictures. I think there was a sex tape or something, but they're pictures of the actual murder. July 9, 2008, she was charged with the first-degree murder of Alexander and then arrested July 15th. September 5th, she was extradited to Arizona, where she, in September, pleaded not guilty. 2 years after her arrest, she admitted to killing him, citing self-defense, that she was a victim and survivor of domestic violence. So let's back it up a little bit to her and Travis's relationship. How much do you know about their relationship?
But I know this was a very like highly publicized case. And aside from it being a cold stone murder from things airing out in court and just being very bizarre, not that much. So I'm interested here, like what her perspective is, how they kind of piece this together as far as the toxic relationship.
Right. Same. So, and then, which made me even more curious of what led her to this. We all know mentally sound people do not kill other people. So what the fuck? And I think a lot of the media stuff was like, oh, but she doesn't look like a killer, because of course killers have a certain aesthetic.
Right. Certain characteristics.
About Jody. Jody was born in Salinas, California. She was the oldest of three siblings, but she did have one older half-sister, and she attended Eureka Union High School, but dropped out in the 11th grade, and then she got her GED. She ended up getting into photography and pursuing a few different jobs. She never had just one specific career route, which it happens. A lot of the information shows that she did a lot of part-time jobs. She was a professional photographer, freelance photographer, and that was a big passion of hers. Her parents, mainly her mom, described her having a good childhood. She was always a good kid. I could not find much about her childhood. I was curious to see if there was any childhood trauma that could kind of explain her mental capacity and how she perceives certain situations. Because, you know, trauma creates a certain type of lens and ways that you cope. So I was trying to find that. I didn't see her say it herself, but an article cited that she said her parents used to beat her with a belt and a wooden spoon when she was seven, that she labeled it as child abuse, but nobody else really said that, so I'm not sure. So that was the only really child abuse claim that she had. Her defense attorney, Kirk Nurmi, said that he himself suspected that she was a victim of sexual abuse because of just the way she presented as an adult. And we'll go into that regarding the personality disorder, because we know trauma, sexual abuse manifest in certain behaviors as adults.
All that attachment.
Right, the attachment and a lot of things that we see in these personality disorders. And so he thought that she was, because her boundaries were just like really awful with him too. So that was really all I got on her childhood. In her 20s, she had a bunch of relationships that ended with her boyfriend's cheating on her, supposedly, is what she told the Arizona courtroom during her trial. That was all I could get on her upbringing. Beginning of her relationship with Travis. So she met him when she was 26. He was 29. She was a freelancer photographer. He was a motivational speaker, salesman, and devout Mormon. Friends said that their connection was instant when they met. It was almost like a blind date. He was going to this conference and a friend introduced them and she ended up being his date. She was really excited about the relationship. She loved how funny he was, how much fun they would have together, and he liked taking adventures and doing things. Although he lived in different states, where he was in Mesa, Arizona, she was in Palm Desert, California. They maintained a long distance relationship for a few months and would meet in Marietta, California, where their mutual friend lived. Yeah, so they started spending more time together, and he really cared for her. Based on an email that he wrote, he said, "I went from intrigued by her to interested in her to caring about her deeply to realizing how lucky I would be to have her as part of my life forever. She is amazing. It is not hard to see that whoever scores Jody, whether it be me or someone else, is going to win the wife lotto." He was equally infatuated with her. But during the relationship, there was such a conflict between the relationship and his faith in Mormonism, because in the Mormon faith, you are not supposed to have premarital sex because that's one of their most important tenets. So that was hard because he was a very sexually active guy, and they engaged in a lot of sexual activities. And in Jody's trial, that's a big piece of what they went into, because the defense painted this picture of that they had an extremely sexually degrading relationship where Travis made her do really, really fucked up things, where he forced her to go into a lot of, they had a lot of anal sex. I guess it was like a loophole, right? If they're not having your typical vaginal sex, then it didn't count, which is...
And it doesn't count, which is not true, kids.
That's not true. Yeah, no, it's not true. It totally counts. And just wear a condom, please. But I don't even have like the brain power or enough time to go into like just how intense their relationship was and how complex Jody is, because she does look very superficial in regards to like, she's also very charming, very articulate in regards to like, she's well spoken, but she goes on these tangents during her interrogation where she's trying to paint a picture of how complex she is and how like relatable she is. So I definitely feel like that's a defense for her. Yeah, they have this very weird tumultuous relationship where he definitely gets what he needs from her sexually, and eventually during the relationship he's like, yeah, you're not wifey material because you give me sex pretty much. And she like from the get-go is like, oh no, I'm wifey material because I give you sex. This is again just speculation based on what I'm seeing, because he's like, I'm not gonna marry you. He starts to distance himself, and I think maybe there were a lot of red flags that he was seeing himself of her coming off very strongly. He started having a lot of guilt about the relationship too. During her trial, she has a bunch of text messages from him. Here's one that's like really intense that I found the defense uses to collaborate her story that he was physically and emotionally abusive, because she did claim that he would hit her and push. Here is one of the texts that he sent to her. This was sent May 26, 2008 to Jody. He wrote, I sent you a response to your dire conversation that I hope you read because you need to read it. Maybe it will spark human emotion in you, something that only seems to exist when it comes to your own problems. But everyone else is just part of your sick agenda. By the way, your pick comment to Danny Jones makes you look like a pure whore. Even more to the people who know you. You should be embarrassed by it. If he knew what I knew about you, he'd spit in your face. So it would everyone else. I have never, never in my life been hurt so bad by someone, but why do I even say it? Because you don't care. It doesn't serve your evilness. And then another text he sent maybe 40 minutes after. You couldn't get off your lazy butt to read it, could you? That's the sociopath I know so well. It freaking figures. And then he would go on and he called her so many names and said that she's just a dildo with a heartbeat.
Oh my, what?
What the fuck? But why is she a dildo? Like, isn't he a dildo? Again, it's so deep, and I think that's what like interests me. And I feel like I'm all over the place because there's so much really to process for her and their relationship and him. I guess he came from a really fucked up childhood too. His parents were drug addicted and really struggling with that, so they weren't fit to be parents. So he ended up living with his grandparents, who were the ones to introduce him to the Mormon faith. So I think he was very loyal to that Mormon faith because that's essentially what saved his life. But again, he has, as any person has, like these sexual urges when you live by this doctrine of like you're not supposed to. I think he was really conflicted, and she ended up, and again speculation, I think he projected a lot of that guilt and responsibility on Jody because she did use sex a lot. From what I saw, she used sex a lot to entice him and to keep him in the relationship. He would try to end it. He felt guilty a lot of times, and this was, I saw in a lot of the articles in the Lifetime movie called Jody Arias, Dirty Little Secret from 2013. So he tried to end it, quit her cold turkey, because I think there was a two-way obsession. When she would not take that breakup, he would say really, really mean things to her, maybe to make sure that she ends it. But I think that made her push even harder to win him, which I think then ties into that personality disorder trait of manipulating. And so let's explore what we think was going on with her. She ended up being examined by, I think, 3 or 4 forensic psychologists. And one psychologist said that she was a textbook sociopath, which we know sociopathy is the antisocial diagnosis if we're going to get, you know, clinical into the DSM-5. When you hear sociopath, they're describing the antisocial disorder, which is part of the cluster B disorder. So just going into the DSM. So to meet that criteria, she must pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others occurring since the age of 15, as indicated by 3 or more of the following. So for her to make that, she must have a failure to conform to social norms with respect to law behaviors, like being arrested a lot. Deceitfulness, indicated by repeated lying, uses of aliases or conning others for personal profit or pleasure, impulsivity or failure to plan ahead, irritability, aggressiveness, repeated physical fights or self, reckless disregard for safety of others or self, consistent irresponsibility, as indicated by repeated failure to sustain consistent work behavior, honor financial obligations, a lack of remorse, indicated by being indifferent or rationalizing having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from others. So hearing that, Nao, what are your thoughts? Do you, in your humble clinical opinion, think she needs antisocial?
That she went and murdered this man. Yeah, I could see it. It makes me wonder, though. So with antisocial, it starts from 50s on, right? But prior to that, what's the diagnosis? Did oppositional defiant disorder that eventually leads up to this?
Oh, conduct.
And then before that, what's the diagnosis? Because I know there's like a lead up to this, right?
The oppositional defiant disorder. So ODD, then the conduct disorder, then antisocial, if we're looking at the pattern, right? Yeah, that's a good point. And nobody and nothing has indicated that she's met any of those prior.
And then it's so hard because like what you mentioned earlier, like we don't have a lot of her childhood or what her formative years or adolescent years were like.
I think the lack of evidence of mental instability or at least diagnosis is so perplexing to me because clearly she is not mentally stable. Clearly she has something going on and maybe she's just one that doesn't have a diagnosis. She's pretty functioning. You know what I mean? She was functioning until this moment and until she fucking broke. Like, he broke her. Did he deserve to be murdered? Absolutely not. And is this justifying her actions? No, but we're here to try to understand. If she was truly antisocial, there would have been some ODD, conduct disorder behaviors, like you were saying. So crime expert Scott Bond labels her as textbook sociopath, saying that she has something severely wrong with her consciousness, calling her the walking embodiment of sociopathy in many ways. To say that she's a walking embodiment of sociopathy, I think, is not a proper diagnosis the way he's trying to do it, because
the most prolific serial killers that we rose to fame, like BTK killer, Ted Bundy, John Gacy, all these folks that they functioned to what they felt was normalcy in order to be able to cater to that awful traits that they got going on because they have a need to murder. This person that comes from, we're not justifying or trying to excuse anybody of their behavior, but a very toxic, volatile relationship. It makes you like wonder if they only get like a one evaluation kind of one time thing. Like, how long do they have to evaluate this person and gather all this information?
Because if you're basing it on just this murder, like, hell yeah, she seems like a sociopath. It's based on this relationship, yes. But if you're going to throw out diagnoses like that, then you have to look at what the diagnostic criteria is in the DSM-5, which is, for our non-clinical friends and listeners, it's the diagnostic, what does DSM stand for? Officially.
Diagnostic statistical manual.
Thank you. Fifth edition. Yeah. So if you're going to use that, like, let's not create inaccurate descriptions of these very harsh labels that we tend to do. I, you know, did a post on one of my Instagrams. Don't use sociopath or psychopath to describe cruel, because some people that are antisocial
Don't murder.
Lots of people that have antisocial don't murder or do fucked up things, right? That type of language is so stigmatizing. Another personality disorder I want to explore with you, and another psychologist that evaluated Jody and described borderline personality disorder.
Maybe just given like the dysfunctional pattern of, like you were kind of saying earlier, he would withdraw, she would pursue, and then she would withdraw, and then he would pursue, and it go back and forth, and all of a sudden she's wifey material, but then she's not. And then she's like, yes, I am. So I'm going to show you. And it just goes back between idolizing and devaluing the relationship.
Yeah, beautifully said. And in the testimony in court, Arias supposedly was like very jealous of Travis seeing other women when they broke up. So they had this long distance relationship where she'd meet and she would visit him, I think. They would travel together, so they never lived in one spot. Then he broke up with her. She moved to Mesa, Arizona, to where he lived a couple months after they broke up. Yeah, you're making a face. And I was like, the fuck is you doing, girl? Because you don't do that. Like, he don't want to be with you. So I think that speaks to kind of, she's not in a rational space. All of this is just like, what the fuck?
So that whole like abandonment is what maybe drives some of the motivation to just continue the relationship, even though it's like an unresolved attachment that just keeps going on this dysfunctional pattern that will never be resolved.
Right. And then she does speak what we do know about her past relationship. Her other boyfriends cheated on her. Could be traumatizing having a partner cheat on you, especially when you have this desire to be loved and everybody that potentially had the opportunity to love you didn't. And if she already has low self-esteem, you know, the way she speaks and the way she presents herself seems very confident, but my own opinion is that she's compensating. In these interrogation videos, she talks about how much she loves an animal, and this is her rationale. She was not the one to kill Travis. Is she's like, I love animals. I think she said she kicked her dog by accident and just felt awful about it. And knowing what she fucking did to Travis, I was like, what? She is not stable. Like, we're not arguing the fact that she was in a good state of mind.
That plane of reality is so blurry for her.
Beautiful. And I'm so glad we're having this conversation. Yes, that like, what is it, delusion? I don't know. Yeah, that reality, that lost sense of reality.
That's kind of where like the name borderline stems from, no? Border to what reality is or is not. And it's just like the way they interpret certain situations. From their perspective, it just makes sense.
Yes. I think looking at the other personalities, disorders, borderline for me, I knew about the case way before I went to grad school and, you know, learned these clinical stuff. So I was like, I don't know what the fuck she is. But now having studied it.
You're just like, that's something ain't right here.
Right. I was like, I don't know, but I need to know more. So I went to grad school. looking at borderline, right? So let's look at the DSM-5 criteria for borderline. For someone to meet the criteria for borderline personality disorder, a pervasive pattern of instability of interpersonal relationships, self-image, and affects, marked impulsivity beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts, as indicated by 5 or more. She has to meet 5 or more of these criteria to diagnostically meet the criteria. So frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment.
Moving to Mesa, Arizona, showing up to the house unannounced.
Yes. If you watch the videos of her trials, they play back these audio recordings that she recorded herself. They're phone sex recordings.
Oh, so she saved the recordings.
Yes, ma'am. I don't know if he knew that she was recording. It didn't show that she recorded it to like play back for herself or for him. So they played it in court. It was the defense. So she must have been, and maybe this goes into her vindictiveness. So going back to the criteria, frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment, pattern of unstable and intense interpersonal relationships characterized by alternating between extremes of idealization and devaluation, which I think I can see. I mean, I don't know if a pattern for her other relationships, but I think for him.
Yeah, there's just very stark contrast in between, like, trying to pursue her and then actually being in a relationship with her. It just completely changes over the course of time.
And I wonder if she did the same with him. Not to say she wasn't guilty of it, but, like, I wonder if she just, like, took everything. Another one, identity disturbance, markedly and persistently unstable self-image and self-sense. We don't see that, and then nobody talks about her having this low self-esteem, but the way she presents and how she tries to overcompensate in how good of a person she is in the interrogation, like, she goes into these tangents. She has so much faith and she doesn't kill animals, but she kicked this dog by accident, but the dog moved in the way of her foot. Like, and then another criteria is impulsivity in at least two areas that are potentially self-damaging: spending, sex, substance abuse, reckless driving. I mean, I think definitely she is impulsive with sex and maybe spending. We don't know any of her money issues. Recurrent suicidal behavior, gestures, or threats. I don't know a history of suicidal behavior or gestures. I don't think she's have self-mutilated, but she's definitely threatened to kill herself multiple times during her and Travis's relationship. When he tries to end it, she has, you know, threatened to kill herself. Another criteria is chronic feelings of emptiness. We don't know if she felt that way because... And then another one is inappropriate intense anger or difficulty controlling anger. Yes, because of the way she reacts to Travis having new girlfriends, him trying to cut her off.
Very emotionally dysregulated.
And then another one is transient stress-related paranoid ideation or severe dissociative symptoms. Maybe that's why she killed him. She dissociated and, again, speculation. I don't know. What led her to kill him? Like, this is why we're here. Like, holy fuck. She didn't have documented history or even just anecdotal history from her friends and family.
Stuff gets aired out in court. Like, if there's any cruelty towards animals, children, other people, it'll get aired out and it'll paint the picture of this person was definitely heading that way.
Right. Even if it was a defense, right? Even if they used it as her defense of, like, but, you know, she's had this childhood and... One of her friends actually was interviewed and said that it was lovely growing up with her. She was super fun to be around, always having a smile on her face. So that's where I wonder if there was a history of sexual abuse, because she was very childlike during her interrogation when they had breaks and times where they would leave and kind of just let her hang out by herself. And she would sing to herself or sing out loud, almost like a self-soothing type of way. And she would talk to herself.
Kind of like regressing a little.
Yeah, and it like almost like a childlike voice, but kind of like a soft voice. It looked very dissociative because she was not in touch with reality. Like, she was not. You are being interrogated for murder. Like, and you would think somebody would be. And again, it's not fair to expect someone to react to a certain situation, right? But just watching her, she seemed, like you said, on this like different plane of reality where, had you not told me the context of her, I would think that she was being held as a witness because she was singing to herself and she did a handstand
in there, like in the
yes, while she was waiting for the investigator to come back, she did a handstand. So I wonder if she was just in this like other mental space to protect herself. That's why I was like, this. I really wonder if there was a history of sexual abuse, because dissociation is a lot of times. So her defense lawyer, Kirk Nurmi, wanted to go a different route for her defense in regards to, you know, being a victim of this toxic relationship, and that it was like kind of a crime of passion. Like, and she went the route of, I am a survivor, but it was not premeditated. So she, as her defense, threw out that he was a pedophile on the stand, that he made her wear Superman underwear because a kid that he mentored was really into Superman. So she would throw these like weird ass like tidbits in there to vilify him. And granted, he was not innocent in this toxic relationship, but she would throw out things that kind of seemed so far out there that like it didn't make her defense any stronger.
I could see how that could probably contribute to maybe how we're kind of seeing that there's a lot of instability here. But what she might be saying is maybe very well true that maybe that was like a thing going on in their relationship. Even though like there's a lot of information out there regarding this case, there's so much missing information.
So what are some of the things that you think would be helpful to know to kind of make sense of her and her actions?
I think for sure, like any childhood history, prior like relationship history, any kind of history of treatment or any kind of like evaluation for like dissociation to realization or depersonalization. There's a lot of history missing that usually we use set up like a pattern to arrive at some of the clinical conclusions that we normally do with treatment.
Another forensic psychologist with the Hawaii Department of Public Safety Corrections Division did not personally examine Arias, but in speaking in general terms regarding similar cases, she said that it is not uncommon in cases such as this for perpetrators to have characteristics of borderline personality disorder. So she does also conclude that she sees the unstable interpersonal relationships and intense fear of abandonment and rejection, and that because of those feelings that are connected with borderline personality disorder, individuals become cruelly punitive towards the people that they perceive as reject them. So again, none of this that we talk about is justification for the horrific thing that she has done, but it kind of helps us understand how certain traits can lead to this. And could it be preventable? I think that's a big piece that I always wonder too, is like if whoever around her life was aware of this, could his death be preventable? Another personality disorder was narcissistic personality disorder, like you were saying, Nao. This particular personality disorder still is cluster B, and for someone to meet criteria for this, it's a pervasive pattern of grandiosity or fantasy or behavior, need for admiration, lack of empathy, begin by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts indicated by five or more. So that person has to have a grandiose sense of self-importance. So exaggerating achievements and talents, or expects to be recognized as superior without actually having any achievements, which I think we kind of hear she exaggerates her achievements and talents for sure. Is preoccupied with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, or ideal love. I think I can see that based on the interrogation videos that she, and the love, like she deserves that love and that she's brilliant. And another criteria that one needs to meet is they believe that he or she is special and unique and can only be understood by other special high status people. So that could be another thing, because Travis was very successful. He was a successful motivational speaker and salesman in this MLM. So multi-level marketing, being associated with him then made her feel like important. So to lose that relationship and connection to him was then a hit to her ego.
And it kind of makes me wonder, like now that you're kind of saying this, like how she presented to law enforcement, to every single of these psychologists, because I think for the most part, folks know that psychologists have PhDs. So I wonder in what way she presented to them and how, you know, she exhibited a lot of these traits and characteristics.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because in those videos that we see in her interaction with the male and female detective, she was subtle in the manipulation. She was like kind of acting very cutesy and mousy a little, going into these examples of how amazing she is and how caring she is to the male investigator. And then they kind of, in the second interrogation, after she was already booked to jail, they had a woman detective, and she was like kind of playing the quote unquote bad cop. And she was like, listen, cut the shit. I know you're smarter than this. And she just shut down. Like she didn't even try to manipulate her in the same way, you know, like she just was like not engaging. She just was like, I don't know. And it was really interesting to watch.
Kind of like that protection again, right? Like, I know I won't be able to do this. So now I gotta kind of go with the flow and just protect myself throughout the situation.
Right, because she knew she wasn't able to control that situation. I mean, she was not controlling the other situation, but in her perceived view, she thought she was. So another piece, another criteria for this narcissistic personality disorder is requiring excessive admiration, having a sense of entitlement, is interpersonally exploitative, so taking advantage of others to achieve his or her own ends, lacks empathy, is unwilling to recognize or identify the feelings and needs of others, shows arrogant, haughty behaviors or attitudes, is often envious of others or believes that others are envious of them. So yeah, I think she hit a lot of those, but I think they're so intertwined, like with the other personality disorder. So I don't know if I was assessing clinician, I don't know if I could fully diagnose her with one of those or any of those.
I could see where she met some criteria for some of them, but kind of like the first professional stated, like a walking description of such and such diagnosis. I'm not really sure either.
Right. It's interesting. And if there's a new diagnosis that has bits and pieces of all of them, then I would probably diagnose her with that one.
Generalized personality disorder.
Really, does it matter? No. Even with any mental health disorder, like in the end, does it matter? Because as long as you're getting help and treatment for it, like, and that's what matters most. For us, what really kind of fucks me up, feel for her too. Like, I feel for Travis and his family because he was brutally murdered and it was very preventable. But she, like, Jodi Arias is now in prison for the rest of her life. And she, I imagine she's been in so much emotional pain that she has brought onto herself too. She fucking snapped. Like, I don't know how else to.
Like, if there's no prior history, and I keep bringing up the history, but I think it's because it's prior patterns, no prevalent history. It was just out of nowhere. Maybe to his friends and family, they were like, hey, you might want to look into Jodi because we've observed this. One thing is to continue like a toxic relationship with all these dysfunctional patterns. But for it to lead up to murder, that is way out there.
Right. And I think in those red flags that they were seeing were those personality disorder traits, right? They were seeing her jealousness and her impulsivity and yeah, all those stuff. So yeah, if for them to continue to engage, unfortunately, Travis paid that awful, awful price. And this is where I'm like, you know what? It is a cold-blooded murder because like those personality disorders and your traumatic background does not justify murdering someone else. And I think the piece of this like completely lack of remorse, and she was trying to cover her ass. She called his phone after she murdered him to leave a voicemail to establish an alibi, saying like, oh, hey, I'm on the road. I'm so and so far from you. We're going to do this. And hey, do you want to come with us? Literally right after she killed him. And then had like a makeout session with another dude afterwards. I mean, they brought that up in the trial courts to be like, she's so cold hearted. Like she made out with someone. But again, that could be her inability to cope with anything. And, you know, she's fine values. Whatever. I'm not even going to fucking dig into that because that's so much more.
I think, I don't know why I'm still stuck on this part, but so you were saying that took pictures of them having a sexual encounter to lead up to the murder, that she keeps taking pictures, like documenting everything that's happening.
Yeah.
So, and then she leaves the voicemail. Some very bizarre and strange details of someone that we've heard so far. Like, how does this fit into this one situation of murder? That's the part that still boggles me.
I think it's her having this like inflated sense of, oh, I'm smarter than the law. I got this. There's so many pieces that I keep forgetting. It's like all over the place. Is this is why they got her premeditated, why she was found guilty of his murder, of capital, I think, because she didn't get the death. Yeah, capital murder, was that she borrowed 2 cans of gas from a friend or something for this road trip. So she didn't have to stop for gas during the route of leaving his house to go back to her house. She was trying to avoid being seen, you know, traveling because she wanted to have this alibi. In addition to that, she had staged a burglary at her grandparents' house, who she had started living with. During that burglary, nothing was really stolen except for her grandfather's handgun, the same handgun that was used to shoot Travis, which they were able to link to her.
So she ended up getting convicted of capital murder?
Yeah.
Okay. Because all of this, did she deny it that it was premeditated? Because from all this, it sounds like it was premeditated.
Her defense, first it was intruders. Then it was self-defense because he was physically and emotionally abusive, which there might have been some truth. And that's another sticky situation of like, there are cases where domestic violence survivors have killed their abuser. Complete premeditation. So that's where it's like, was it impulsive? If you premeditate Murder? No, I don't think so, right?
Well, and I can see where, like, if she had some patterns of behavior as far as being volatile and just having very poor impulse controls, not only in the areas of toxic relationship, but let's say, like, spending, gambling, shopping, all these other areas in life. But it just so happened that in this case, it's volatile, but it sounded like it served a function to exhibit all these behaviors, but also do this. And put it in the washer, thinking that that will somehow wash away.
That's why she's such an interesting person to me, because she does have this, like, I feel like inflated thing of, like, I'm hella smart. Because she thinks, like, staging the burglary, doing that voicemail as an alibi, putting that camera, and then to have the gall to take pictures. I don't think she didn't take pictures on purpose of the murder, but it was like in her hand, like she was taking a picture and then she attacked. So it was like accidentally taken. It's so different from, like, I'm a survivor of domestic violence. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
people might think like, oh, I got to delete this so they don't know that I was here at such and such time frame. I got to clean up.
It's very messy. Like, she thought of smart things, but, like, it wasn't a clean enough break to not have her involved. When she was charged with his murder, and then so she was in jail awaiting her trial, she had CBS or ABC. She gave them an interview almost immediately to talk about her. And they had the camera recording, right? So she's talking to the reporter. She's like, oh, I think I was supposed to talk to you. She's like, oh, your job sounds really cool. You have to travel. She's like, hold on, I have to put my makeup on. Don't roll the tape yet. And then puts makeup on.
So she's front and center stage, and she knows why she's there. And she says, don't roll because I'm the star. Let me put my makeup on.
Prior to that, during her first interrogation, still in her civilian clothes, she had not been booked yet. She was arrested and they're interrogating her. So at the end, the detective was like, listen, like, we've been at it for hours, but I have enough to charge you for murder. So you're going to go to jail. You're going to go across the street to get booked. She's like, do I have to be handcuffed the whole time? He's like, yes, that's procedure. She's like, I know this is going to sound real shallow, but can I, like, clean myself up before I take the picture? She has some insight to how she presents, but, like, what the fuck?
Yeah, like, what was that criterion 3 from the narcissistic disorder? Mentioning beauty and appearance, self-image.
That's why I'm, like, so out of my mind. Like, she's so complex, but so not. Like, she seems so black and white. After exploring it with you, like, I think she does meet narcissistic personality disorder. Her narcissistic ways of thinking causes her to do these stupid ass things.
And I guess from the naked eye, you can think, like, this is so out of character. No wonder, like, her childhood friend was like, what? But I think if we take, like, maybe after all of this, the friend, like, took a look back in time and was, God, like, there might be times or situations where some stuff seemed maybe questionable.
Yes, I think, again, hindsight, when something has happened and then you can then post-mortem look at things, it makes a little more sense. So I wonder, there's a lot of functioning sociopaths. There's a lot of functioning antisocial personality disorders, right? A lot of CEOs are diagnosed with antisocial behaviors because you meet those traits. It doesn't mean that you're a killer. That I think we have to make it known to the public that being a sociopath, psychopath does not make you a killer. It is a mental health clinical diagnosis. So maybe she did have those narcissistic behaviors growing up, but because they don't hurt people, or maybe they weren't severe enough to negatively impact others, that people are like, oh, she's awesome. Because maybe she's like, always, oh, I'm always going to be beautiful. So I need to always look this way. And she needs to always look, to always be super smart. A lot of it is internalized.
Just, like you said, very complex. So, I heard you kind of, like, say, like, I'm all over the place, but I think it's because they're all over the place. Like, they are Oh man, where to even begin?
She was all over the place in regards to her defense. Their relationship was all over the place. Her murder itself was all over the place. The trial, and not to even fucking complicate more things, but they were trying to throw out the murder conviction after she was found guilty because they felt that the prosecutor, Juan Martinez, was too severe in how he prosecuted Jody and the witnesses. So, I mean, it didn't hold up, obviously, because she's still found guilty. But before her sentencing, it was noted that she did express remorse. I don't know, who's to say she felt it? You know what I mean? Like, whatever. That's my opinion. She did say, "To this day, I can't believe that I was capable of doing something terrible. I'm truly disgusted and repulsed with myself. I'm horrified because of what I did, and I wish there was some way I could take it back." So, I mean, for her to even say that, I think shows something, but I don't know what that something is.
Maybe she is struggling with the reality of the outcomes because her reality is just different for her. What we see is not what they're interpreting in their own mind.
I think this was a good case of, like, for us both trained in it and we practice in our careers of diagnosing people, we're still perplexed by this situation. To say she was a complete sociopath, I don't think justify or explain why she did it. She may not even know herself, honestly. Jody hit me up. No, I'm just kidding. That's the murder of Travis Alexander in case of Jody Arias. Thank you, Nao, for walking down that spiral with me. Yeah, some of my resources I want to list because I didn't do that in the beginning were from Dr. Todd Grand, ABC News. They had an article about her February 2020, JCS Criminal Psychology YouTube, the Lifetime movie, Jody Arias, Dirty Little Secret, famouspeople.com, an article from businessinsider.com.
And that's it for today's episode.
Till next time, homies.
Thank you for joining us, and be sure to come back next week where we continue to explore true crime, psychology, the paranormal, mental health, and everything in between. We would love to hear from you, so email us at millennialtherapistspod@gmail.com with your ghost stories, paranormal experiences, questions about therapy and counseling, or the social work field. And don't forget to share, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Remember, you are valued, you are enough,
and you are not alone.
Please subscribe and review. Bye-bye.
Although we are licensed mental health therapists and may cover therapy-related subjects, the topics in this podcast should not substitute professional, psychological, or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
If you are a victim of a crime, which includes but not limited to stalking, human trafficking, financial crimes, or sexual assault, please know the Victim Connect Resource Center can help. They are a referral helpline where crime victims can learn about their rights and options confidentially and compassionately. A traditional telephone-based helpline is 1-855-4-VICTIM or 1-855-484-2846. Or you can connect with them at chat.victimconnect.org or at the website victimconnect.org.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, whether they are considering suicide or not, please call the toll-free lifeline available 24/7 across the United States by calling 1-800-273-8255 or visit suicidepreventionlifeline.org. U.S. and Canadian listeners can also text HOME to 741-741 to connect with a trained crisis counselor. UK listeners text HOME to 85258 and Ireland listeners text HOME to 50808. For more mental health resources and support, international listeners can visit the website unitedgmh.org/mental-health-support to find more mental health services and resources.
And if you are a veteran in crisis or concerned about one, connect with the Veteran Crisis Line to reach caring, qualified responders with the Department of Veterans Affairs at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 or text 838-255. Or you can always visit veteranscrisisline.net.
If you or anyone you know may be experiencing domestic violence, you can find resources and support with the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Visit thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233.